Turn with me to the book of John just for a few minutes this morning. I want to talk about chapter 4 with you. We're working our way backward and we're almost finished, which is important because I've told a number of people that we will be finished by August, and that conversation will be a good one. But anyway, the point being, we're going to be in chapter 4, and we're going to talk a little bit especially about the first part of chapter 4. And there is something here, and this is a very familiar story that's been used for a lot of different purposes. This story, it's interesting when you come across these, and especially in John, it feels like you come to places that people have often taught. I mean, because John is John, and everybody loves John, and everybody teaches from John, and when you first come to Christ or you're first in the process of being discipled, people say, you should read John. And there's a lot of sermons that come from John, and it's been fascinating to me as I've worked my way through this study how much of my assumptions, and I know we talked about this right when I first introduced the book of John in 2004, the idea that we have, just kidding, it hasn't been quite that long, but it feels like it sometimes. We've been looking at the fact that John has a purpose or a point, an agenda that he intends to accomplish with this account of Jesus. He wants us to know that Christ is who he claims to be. He is God himself. And how often what we end up doing, especially with John, is that we will take these stories that John recounts and we'll snatch them out of the context that they're intended, the purpose that John put those there for, to sort of showcase the deity of Jesus and the fact that here there's life, actual life in Christ. And we turn it into sort of social commentary, or we turn it into sort of this means of coming to understand what your salvation does. And again, I don't necessarily think that that's altogether wrong, but it's fascinating how it gets used. And this particular story, the one that we're going to look at in just a minute, is definitely one of those. But before we do that, let's remind ourselves of what we saw last time. We were looking at the second half of chapter 4 there, where Jesus has been back to his hometown, so to speak, his home area, his home region, and he encounters the son that's ill of the leader that's there. And we remember we talked about a few different things. Let's just rehearse a little bit what we saw. We talked about the fact that receiving Jesus out of curiosity or self-interest isn't the same thing as belief. And that was the thing we said that was kind of confusing in that first part. Remember, we run across that thing where Jesus has prophesied or said, I don't receive honor in my hometown. And then the very next verse says, so they welcomed him. And you think, what? What is that? How is that not receiving honor? And in particular, when you look contextually, especially the rebuke that Jesus gives to those who are there to waiting for him to sort of demonstrate power, that all they want is signs, right? All they want is proof of sort of the magic. And there's a difference between believing in Jesus and receiving him out of curiosity or self-interest. And so we know that. We understand that to a measure, but we've got to be really cautious, because my experience in my own walk with Christ is that often I forget to believe in him. Instead, I'm just sort of a follower of his, which I know sounds weird, but there's something important that we missed there. We also talk about the idea that Jesus rebukes unbelief that is looking to manipulate God, not sincere seeking, looking to confirm God. And we especially, you'll remember Leslie talked last time about the idea that, you know, is it wrong to seek a sign from God? And in fact, these people who were there looking for signs, what was the problem? Why was that worthy of a rebuke? And we talked about the difference between a manipulation, the manipulative intent that says, I want Jesus to do my, you know, to do it for me or do something that I'm amazed by, rather than saying, God, I believe in you. And I need to confirm that this is you. And there's a big difference between that. And we see that even develop in the heart of the leader as his son is healed. We talked about that sometimes a no isn't what we think it is. God has a way of answering our prayers with more than we knew we were even asking for. Remember, this ruler got a no. What was his question again? What was the question that this ruler asked of Jesus? What was his request? Come with me. My son is sick, almost dead, right? And does Jesus do that? No. He doesn't do that. He says, you go, he'll be fine. And there's something about that that we sort of need to confront in our own expectations here, because we have a tendency to come to Christ with these expectations. I know how you work, God, so come with me and do what I know you'll do. And God doesn't play that way. And what was the reason that God wanted, particularly, why was John forcing us to look at this miracle, especially when he has these seven signs of the fact that Jesus is in fact divine? I argued that it's because it demonstrates something about Christ, about God himself, that is super important. And that is that his authority is not just face-to-face authority. His authority goes beyond just his presence, his mere presence. And that's important for us now, especially, and those who were coming to recognize the truth of who God was, to really be confronted with. And so Jesus demonstrates a yes, but he answers it in a way that is actually more powerful than if he had traveled with the guy. And the other thing I think that's interesting, and I didn't really touch on this last week, but I was just, you know, contemplating even more as we were driving home. You know, there's this crowd, right? This crowd that's gathered around waiting for Jesus to do something amazing. And they're all super excited and enthusiastic about Jesus doing something. And this guy, this important guy in the region, comes and says, "My son is almost dead. Come heal." Cool. Let's go. Let's watch him do it. And Jesus says, "You go. You go. Your son will be well." He doesn't bring the show with him, right? And so my question sort of, I wonder in my mind, how many of those people were like, "Aw, like that's not something we get to watch because it's going to happen over there and we're over here." And there's this, again, that sort of sense in which we have this, that belief we talked about before that's intended to seek a sign, not for the value of the authority that it demonstrates, but just for the value of the entertainment, right? And I don't know. I mean, about the only people I think that really got to be first to see firsthand the healing of the son would be the servants, because they come and meet him on the road. We're like, "Hey, he's better, boss. And it worked." And then he asks, and this is the last one we look at, is that, you know, their question of this man after he encounters his healing. Belief grows in response to God's answers, and faith is strengthened through a review of God's faithfulness. I really love the story as it continues there. As he encounters these servants, and they say, "He's better." And he thinks, "It worked." I mean, and again, we talked last time about the heaviness of heart that this father would have to his son is on the verge of death. There is no final hope. This is it, this or death. And there is such an urgency in his mind and in his heart that he needs Jesus more than anything he's ever needed in his entire life. He needs Jesus to come help. And that load is lifted in that moment. And he begins to review in his mind what has happened. And he asks a very important question of his servants. When? When did it happen? When? And the answer that they give confirms in his mind and in his heart and in every part of himself that Jesus was exactly who he claims to be. And the power that Jesus possessed is demonstrated to him. And he believes in all his house, right? The belief that follows. So we already are told he believes the word of Christ. It says earlier in the passage, he believed his word. But man, when he comes to this place where he realizes the power of Jesus can go across space to heal, the belief that he comes into, that he steps into after rehearsing and reviewing the goodness of God, is strengthened in a way that really, it's hard to overestimate that. He is so convinced of the truthfulness of who Jesus was. And so this picture that we saw was important for us to remind us of what is true about healing and about life. So this week we're going to read a different portion here. We're going to read John chapter 4, verses 1 through the end of that story there. So we'll read it together, and we'll stop at a few points, and I want to point out just a couple things that stand out in this particular narrative here. Now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee. So this is interesting in itself, because this goes back to something that we've talked about multiple times. My time is not yet come. How often was that statement rehearsed to the disciples by Jesus? It's not time yet. It's not time yet. It's not time yet. And there's a sense, especially here early in Jesus' ministry, when he is doing things that we wouldn't anticipate. Remember, we looked a few chapters later where his family says, "You need to go back to the big city and take the show on the road because you're losing disciples with your crazy talk. You need to get yourself back on track here. You're building up. If this is what you want to do, Jesus, if you decide to give up carpentry for this, you need to do it the right way." And there's a sense in which you recognize Jesus' awareness of that. And he is recognizing something, this growing frustration that the Pharisees have. They hear that he is making and baptizing more disciples than John. So the thing that I can't wrap my mind around here, especially, is the idea that they were sort of jealous of John and Jesus both at the same time, but they had to pick a team, right? And by the way, the Pharisees had been picking teams. Some of them had actually had appreciation for John's ministry. Remember, John's message wasn't one that was completely foreign to them and to their understanding. He's saying, "Make straight the paths," and he's saying, "Look, get it together. What's wrong with you people?" And the Pharisees are like, "That's our message too. Woo, go John." But then there were others that are like, "Yeah, but we didn't authorize him." And so they were already starting to build that frustration over the way he was going about his ministry. And then Jesus really throws them for a loop. But there had already been sort of this division over the ideas or the plans of which one they were going to be part of. And Jesus does not step into that controversy. He does not come in to clarify anything. What is the issue, especially, that sort of distinguished, and we know this, especially when you look backward in history, what was some of the differences between Jesus' ministry and John's ministry? One of the key components was the baptism question, right? You remember that when the disciples are like, well, which baptism is it? Is it this baptism? Is it that baptism? How does this thing work? And there were questions about the particularities of how the process worked. And Jesus does not get involved in that question. He just leaves. He walks away from the controversy that's growing there, and he walks away from an opportunity, at least in my head, to answer the questions of the people here about what specifically, which baptism, and how do the baptisms work, and what's your authority, and is John your cohort, or is he your opponent, or how does this work? He didn't have anything to do with that, because he was being led by God's Spirit into the things that were most important for him. And so at that point, he doesn't get involved in the controversy. Instead, he departs for Galilee. And we remember that's the place that he's going to end up when he encounters this ruler and his son. So he has to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well, and it was about the sixth hour. So we're given, again, historical context here and regional context. So what do we know about Samaria? What, I mean, you guys are well-versed in Scripture. What's the significance of this particular part of the story? Why is this identified for us, besides just giving us geographic markers? Jews aren't on board so much with the Samaritans. They weren't really on board with Samaria. Why was that? Do we know why they had such a bad opinion of them? Yeah. No, that is one of the words. Yeah. So they weren't all in with the Jews, right? They didn't do it the way the Jews wanted it done. In fact, if you go back in history, you realize that they were planted there by an opposing king. The Assyrian king had put them there purposefully to mess with the Jews, and they had mixed up sort of the Jewish faith. They had certain, they only accepted the first five books of the law. That were the only books that they ascribed to. They reestablished worship in their space, right? Bethel instead of in Jerusalem. So they had all of this competing religious structure. And again, their start was intended to be a thorn in the side of the Jews. And so they were bothered by these people. You are not pure, you know, purely Jewish, pure-blooded. You've taken our religion and co-opted it for yourself. You're claiming rival status with our religious structure. I mean, you guys know how this works in countries now, where somebody would, you know, imagine somebody steps into your land, takes your space, sets up their own religion that looks almost like yours, but they say theirs is better. I mean, that's not going to make for good, friendly conversation. And that was the issue. There was massive conflict that existed here. Interestingly enough, as well, the Jacob's well issue, right? As well. Huh, see what I did there? Jacob's well, we have this story specifically there where the well of Jacob is, and that has significance also historically for the Jews as well as for the Samaritans. They would argue that Jacob is their father. The Jews tended to be the more pure would tend to say that Abraham was their father. They didn't really want to claim Jacob as their father. The Samaritans were a little bit more on board with that. They have his well, so they might as well make him sort of the chief tenet of their belief structure. And so there's this constant warring between them and frustration and animosity. And so in that context, you have Jesus who is passing through. Now, some have said that they won't go there, and that's a good, you know, the idea that they don't want to go there. But it's a little different than that they wouldn't. Some have said that they would actually take the long way around. I've read some commentaries that would say they would actually run around in order to get to where they needed to go. And so it was really unusual for Jesus to be walking through that. And that might be true for some of them, but they're just like us. So my guess is, and I think especially if you go to Josephus, it seems like they would go through, but they would hold their nose, right? They would go through, but they would make a point of saying, it's despising to me. It's disgusting that we have to take this journey. Oh, gracious. What's a stench? It's like walking through Greeley. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I came out and I didn't mean to say it, and we're going to strike that from the record. But the material point is, you know, you're walking through this space and you make the point the whole time. Oh, this is awful. Why are we here? Why do we have to be here? And you're like, well, you don't. If you really think that, you could go the long way. And there were those on principle that would go the long way. But as a general rule, they would go through and they would make a point of their disgust. how awful it is. And so Jesus is walking through, and he's, and again, the idea would be that you sort of have to make hay out of the fact that you hate it there. And Jesus sits down on Jacob's well. One other thing, I meant to say this and I forgot. Jacob's well is at the base of Mount Gerizim. Do we know anything about Mount Gerizim? Ebal and Gerizim, if I bring those together, do we know anything about those? Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So Mount Ebal is where they have the Mount of Cursing. Mount Gerizim was the one that they would stand on, and they would say, "Blessed is the man who." And they would proclaim the law from and shout across this valley, "This is blessed." And then from the opposite side, "This is cursed. This is blessed. This is cursed." And they had used these. And again, there's some significance there that I'm not going to get into just right now. But even the fact that Mount Gerizim is right there near their area gave them another claim for, because remember, there was an altar that was built there that was supposed to be more or less without any tools touching it. It was really the altar that represented Christ. But again, I want to get excited about that, and we could step into that space. We're not for now, because it would make it inefficient for what we're really looking to accomplish here, and I think John's point. But Mount Gerizim also has a significance, and all this stuff is swirling around, and Jesus sits down at this well, and he's tired. It says it's the sixth hour. Now, that could mean one of two things. If they're measuring with Jewish time, then it means that it's like noon, like heat of the day. If they're measuring with Roman times, which it seems like probably it's more Roman time that was used by John potentially, it means it's the end of the day. But either way, it's hot. One way or the other, he's been walking through the heat. Either it's the heat of the day or it's the end of that day. And he's tired, and he sits down on this beside this well to rest. All right? He's weary. And a woman from Samaria came to draw water. And Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. And the Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." And Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." So this woman addresses Jesus. You know, she walks up to the well to draw her water. And a lot of people have talked about the fact that it's a very unusual time, perhaps, for her to be at the well even. The theory is that she has been sort of run off from the well because of her reputation. And so she has to go at times when are less efficient, less crowded at the well, so that other people don't judge her or whatever. But anyway, she's there and she's going to draw some water. And Jesus asks her a simple question. Again, this is a question of hospitality. And in our culture, we can't miss that, or in their culture especially. But for us, we don't recognize. This question puts him, he's basically asking for her to extend to him hospitality, which was something that was hugely valued in that culture, was hugely important. And for you to do that, to extend the hand, even if it is to an enemy, of hospitality, binds you to the other. To the place where we were reading in Judges, man, that binding that happens, if you receive somebody into your house, that hospitality goes to the place where you're willing to give up your own children for the sake of hospitality. So you're binding yourself to this person by asking them for hospitality. Jesus says, "I am willing to A, talk to you, and B, I am willing to bind myself to you by asking for you to extend to me hospitality." And that whole, "they had no dealings," means that they would rather die of thirst than put themselves in a place of being bound on by hospitality to a Samaritan, right? And he asks her for a drink. And she says, "This is strange. This is unusual on multiple levels. I'm confused. Why are you doing this?" And Jesus says, "If you knew who I am, what the gift of God was, you would ask an entirely different question." And he begins to suggest to her that there is living water to be had. And the woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water?" Now, we immediately assume that this is sort of like Nicodemus, by the way, which is the one that comes before this one, which is the one we're going to look at next, is that same type of situation where basically there's confusion because she's thinking in literal terms. Living water could also be translated flowing water or moving water. And so she might have honestly been thinking, "Oh, so he wants to get me a drink. I mean, what is the point here? He asked me for water, and then he's going to give me a drink, and I'm not sure. What are you trying to talk about? What do you mean by this water that you have? This well is deep." And by the way, the well was deep. Theory is that it was anywhere from 60 to 100 feet deep, and it was filled by underground wells, springs that were there. This is a deep well. You got to have a lot of rope to get to the water here. And she recognizes that and she asks, how do you find this water? Where do you get it? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock. So now she's also transitioning into talking about, look, this is strange that we're having the conversation in the first place. And I think, and this is just my theory here, but I have a feeling that when he like turns the tables on her, she's like, hey, give me a drink. And she's like, why are you asking for me a drink? You know, from me a drink. This doesn't work that way. He's like, actually, I'll give you a drink. You almost wonder if she thinks, is this a trick? Is this like the new Jewish trick that you're going to do? And so she starts to introduce this idea. Well, we have Jacob's well. And you can kind of almost see her put her hands on her hips like, we got a thing here, and it's Jacob's, and we're okay. And so don't turn this into a whole argumentation over who has the better well or the better source of water, et cetera. And she's honoring this well. And again, it's another thing. Jesus, are you trying to suggest? Because I can imagine Jews in the past say, psh, Jacob's well, who needs it? Ugh, it's disgusting. You know, no, we have Jacob's well. And so she's excited by that idea. And so she mentions it to him. Are you trying to say that you're better than Jacob? And Jesus says to her, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. That statement, guys, is filled up more than I could possibly express in one morning with you. Of truth, of significance, of hope and of satisfaction. What do we know when we've looked at the living water claim that Jesus makes later when he's at the libation ceremony in the temple, or I am the living bread come down from heaven. His statement is, I will meet more than just your immediate need. I will meet every need you will ever have from now to the end of time. I am that kind of God. I can give you water that quenches your thirst better than anything you've ever had, and it will never end. And it is not the kind of thirst that is just simple water. It's bigger than that. And by the way, she's a thirsty lady, and I don't just mean for water. Jesus understands the significance of her need as well, and he proclaims in that moment, I can give you something that will finally, inside of you and forever, satisfy. He is proclaiming hope that goes beyond anything she's ever heard. The woman said to him, sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water. Some have said that this is a sarcastic statement. I don't buy it. Not at all. I think she sincerely says, this sounds amazing. And I have been waiting my life to have this kind of satisfaction. I'll take it. Give it to me. I'll take it. Whatever it is, I will take it, sir. Give it to me. I want that water. That is the heart of somebody who's about to come to faith. I want satisfaction that's bigger, that's greater than the things that I've had up to this point. And Jesus says to her, you got it. Your faith has made you whole, right? No. What does he say to her? Go, call your husband and come here. Go, call your husband and come here. This right here is when Jesus is answering for her a question that she didn't know she was asking. Right? Because she's thinking still sort of like, okay, so how does this thing work? Like I always have water and I never have to actually get water. And Jesus says, it's bigger than water. The thirst that you have is also bigger than water. Go find your husband and bring him here. Go find him, bring him here. And she answers truthfully, but evasively at the same time, right? She answers, I have no husband, right? I have no husband, which by the way is true. And Jesus says, yes, you're right. You answered half the point. And most people would stop there, right? Oh, okay. No husband, moving on. But that wasn't the question he was asking her, was it? He was asking her a question about her heart condition, about her thirst, her desire for acceptance, for somebody to truly satisfy. Now listen. And we know this, well, let's read it and then I'll talk about it. And Jesus said to her, you are right in saying, I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not even your husband. What you have said is true. So Jesus makes this statement to her in the face of her confession that I don't have a husband. He says, you're correct, you don't. But you've had five, and the one you have now isn't yours, which means one of two things either, right? We both know that means one or two things. Either way, not good. And that is identifying something. Now, people love to jump to this place right here, and they go this place, and they go to another spot in John especially, where they tend to sort of berate the lady, and she shares the fault here. But don't forget the culture. Did she get to divorce these men? She didn't. That's not her prerogative, right? Culturally and legally, and I know you're in Samaria, so maybe things are a little different, but it was close enough to Jewish culture, and it was in this area in general where that wasn't acceptable. So these men had taken her as wife and then divorced her. 5 times she had been rejected by these men. And she finally gave up trying to find security and satisfaction in that culture. And she says, fine, if I'm not going to have it, I might as well at least have a roof over my head. She has been longing for something. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, the intention here is not to completely call her an innocent. But don't make her out to be this harlot in your head. She is thirsty for something. She is longing for something that only God can satisfy. And she has been waiting for it her whole life. And she has given up. And Jesus comes into that moment and he says, I understand your thirst. And I can meet that need in a way that nothing else you've found up to this point can meet it. I can offer you water that satisfies you. The woman says to him, you know, can you imagine? In that moment, you've confessed the truth. She didn't lie. She says, oh, I have no husband. And there is probably in her heart a little bit of that shame and rejection that comes along with that statement. There's a stigma. There's an embarrassment along with that. I have no husband. And again, especially when a Jewish rabbi says, go get your man, what often would mean by that is, I'm done talking to you. This is man talk now. So you need to go find your protector and I'll give him the keys to the thing you need. And so she might be assuming, I was this close to what I needed, and then I needed a guy, and I don't have one. I don't have what I need to get what he's offering. There's assumptions that could come into her mind in that moment. She says, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. But now he confesses something to her that either means the end of the conversation. Again, she's waiting for the other shoe to fall. I mean, think of the culture. She's waiting for the other shoe to fall. You've been talking to me, and I thought you might be turning the tables on me by saying, ha-ha, you can't get the water I can. And I thought maybe you were going to try to tell me that your water is better than our water, but you haven't done any of that. And now we're at this point now where I'm still waiting for this other shoe to fall, where you're going to sort of castigate me for the fact that I've had five husbands and the one that I have now. I mean, that is a pretty serious accusation that's being leveled against her. You are not currently attached to a man, but you're with someone. Whew. How do you know? Who have you been talking to? This is uncomfortable. Sir, I perceive that you were a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. This just, man, you come to a screeching halt, don't you? And the whole story, like you hit this part and you're like, what? What is she asking? Like, why does she do this? And there were two good commentaries that I lean heavily on now because they answered something that didn't quite meet here. So I got this impression from a lot of commentaries that basically this is the evasion, right? She's saying, whoa, I don't want to talk about my man problems. Let's get back to the thing that we all fight over all the time, Jews versus Samaritans. And there could be that. But there is another option that I think kind of makes sense. Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Where does one go? She's a seeker. Where does one? How do you get to what you're talking about? Where does worship happen? How do we get to this? Because is it in our space? Is it in your space? You're a prophet. Solve for me because I want hope. I want an answer. I need an answer. So we've heard it said that you know, our mountain, and notice this mountain, right? Again, that's why I said Gerizim matters. This mountain that they consider a holy mountain did have connections to holy God at multiple levels. And so they're like, they're not just inventing a new thing. Like, oh, let's make that mountain God's mountain. No, there was actually significant connection to Gerizim. And they're like, we do want God, or at least to a measure, and is it this mountain or is it in Jerusalem? How do I find what I'm looking for? I want to find the answer. And Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. And the woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. And Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. So she wants answers to an age-long question, argument over how to get to God. And Jesus says, look, there are arguments on both sides. You worship what you don't know. We worship what we do know to a measure because we actually do have the law. And Jesus isn't throwing to the side the significance of the Jews as the conduit by which God comes through and into the world. He's saying we do know this stuff, but there is a coming a time when neither mountain, neither space, neither temple will be the source or access point into me. Because there is going to come a time, and is now here, when spirit, worship in spirit and in truth, will be the way to come into Christ, to come into God. And she knows this, because again, the Samaritans had sort of this mixture that included the understanding of a coming Messiah. And she proclaims what she is truly hoping for. I'm waiting for Messiah. And Jesus says, you found him. It's me. I am here. He proclaims to her that he is the one that she's been waiting for, the one that she's been looking for. So he identifies the significance of what it means, what is true worship. This is important for us because I noticed something, a shade of something, I suppose, in the struggle that exists between the Samaritan woman and her culture and the Jewish culture. There was a hang-up in their hearts over how to get God. There was this struggle about how to go about understanding and being part of the system that was Yahweh, and they were trying, to a measure, to get it right. And we are in that same space where we identify a false understanding that exists in another spot, and we think, that's a corruption of truth. But the problem is that unless that same corruption can exist in the flip side in your own heart. The answer to the question, how do I get the water that satisfies my deepest longing, my deepest need, is only found in Christ by his Spirit. It's a spiritual reality. And it covers everything and it touches everything. And there is deep significance to Jesus' proclamation here of what would be met, what would be needed. When the disciples, Justin, the disciples come back, and they marveled that he was talking with a woman, but no one said, what do you seek, or why are you talking with her, right? So they come back, and they see him talking to a girl, and they're like, it's not supposed to happen, which, by the way, Jesus calls himself a rabbi, and he's called rabbi or teacher. That doesn't automatically mean that he was recognized as a rabbi, but still, he was considered a spiritual guru to a measure in that culture, and there was a rule that says, better to burn the law than to give it to a woman. That was a rabbinical teaching. Like, they'd have that, like, tattooed on themselves and different things. I mean, it's weird. Probably not tattooed, but you get the point. Better to burn the law than to give it to a woman. And so here he is speaking with this woman, especially in private, when no one else was around, and we all kind of wonder about her reputation and the idea that's going on here, and they see that, but they're not really sure what to say, right? Because if they throw an accusation at Jesus, well, then that's actually throwing an accusation at themselves, and so they don't really say anything, but they're confused by that. They're like, they didn't go to her and bother her, and they didn't ask him anything. So the woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, come, see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ? That question reminds me again of the thing we talked about last week. There's a good way to ask that question and a bad way, right? Can this be the Christ? Sure, prove it, right? As opposed to, guys, this might be it. Could it be? Come help me figure this out because I think it might be. He knows a lot more than a normal guy. Come with me. And help me see if this is true, because it seems true. And I want it to be true. Come with me. Could this be Messiah, the one we've been waiting for? And they went out of the town and were coming to him. Meanwhile, the disciples were urging him, saying, Rabbi, eat! Why? Well, because that's what they just got done doing. I mean, no offense, but we went into town, and we had to go into Samaria. I mean, I'm just saying, it was no easy trip, friends. You know, you can imagine all the jokes that come along with that. We found food ye should eat. They're expecting he'd been wearied, and they're trying to meet his need, which is a great good thing. But again, Jesus wants to draw their attention to something significant in this moment. But he said to them, I have food to eat that you do not know about. So the disciples said to one another, has anyone brought him something to eat? What? We didn't have to go into town? Aaron, let me tell you now, you know that'd be frustrating, right? Somebody sends you in for food, like your wife or somebody you love, and you get back and she's like, I'm good. You're like, okay,
I just went and got you food. Why are you good?
Well, I have other food.
Okay. Good. I'm glad we got that clear.
There's a frustration in their heart.
What? Who got him food? We just wasted our time and went into a place we don't want to be in to get him food, and somebody else brought him food. And Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Do you not say there are yet 4 months? Then comes the harvest. Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes and see that the fields are white for harvest. Already the one who reaps is receiving wages and gathering fruit of eternal life, so that sower and reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap for that which you did not labor. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labor. Jesus says, look what is being accomplished. Look what is coming. There are a lot of people that talk about the theory that Jesus' statement, this sort of picture that he says, the field is white to harvest, would have been perhaps this scene of all of these, especially the men, coming from town in their white tunics. And he sees these men and these people coming from the city, and he says, look at the harvest. And I'll tell you now, there's shades of Jonah that show up here too, because again, who in heaven's name would want there to be a large harvest in Samaria? I mean, we got to get through here. We're just here for a minute. And Jesus stays 2 days, we discover, which, by the way, the jokes just keep coming. Like, that's not a place you stay. That's a place you move through. But Jesus says, look at the harvest that's coming. Look at what is happening. My food, my sustenance, my satisfaction is to do the will of my Father. It supplies me with energy. It supplies me with what I need to live, to do the will of the Father. Look and recognize that there is a harvest to be had. And many Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me all that I ever did. So when the Samaritans came to him, they asked him to stay with them, and he stayed for 2 days. And many more believed because of his word. And they said to the woman, it is no longer because of what you said that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves. And we know that this is indeed the Savior of the world. Such a beautiful expression of the gospel. Such an incredible picture of what God accomplished, what Christ accomplishes as he meets the true need. Come find a man. Come see a man who told me all I'd ever did and didn't judge me, but forgave me for that and gives me now water that wells up within me and lives that I don't have to crave something that I'll never get any longer. There's a fullness, there's a satisfaction, and others come to Christ because of her proclamation and say, we heard what you said, and now we see that it's true. And there's a confirmation. Remember, that's what she asked. Come, confirm with me, because I think this is the Christ. And others come, and they recognize him as Christ. And for 2 days, he continues to teach and proclaim what is true about himself. This is interesting, especially because it comes on the heels of Nicodemus. And you do see, and especially it's like the center, right? The creamy center between Nicodemus and the story that you encounter in Galilee where no prophet receives honor. And you wonder, why is there this mass revival in a place like Samaria? And you know the answer. In your own mind and heart, you recognize that our expectations, especially for the Jews who read this and for the Jews that had encountered this, especially the disciples, the expectations of what God was intending, of what God meant to accomplish, and the reality of what he was going to do were often two very different things, which is part of the reason why the Pharisees had such frustration with Christ. But fundamentally, we recognize that Jesus proclaims something that we all know is true and must ourselves also proclaim, and that is that Jesus meets your deepest longing in a way that only he can. The source of life, of hope, of satisfaction is found in Jesus. And everything else that you pursue, even good, great things, apart from that, are ash. They leave you with nothing. They leave you longing for more. There is only one answer. And that's the thing that Jesus identifies for this woman. Beautiful story. What are some other things that we need to make sure that we hone in on here? Is there anything in particular that God's Spirit drew your attention to as we looked at this?
Mm-hmm. Where do we go to worship? Mm-hmm. You guys say it's the same, we say it's the same, and you know what we're doing. It's sort of like she's asking, well, what's the way to God? And he says,
yeah.
You know, it's that exact same structure.
Yep.
And really looking for God of some. I don't. I think it can. It doesn't necessarily have to be qualified. Like, there are so many people that are legitimately looking for truth and legitimately looking for what's right, ourselves included. And it's not that. Well, we're sort of looking for what's true.
Right.
Not really. We're sort of looking for God.
Sure.
Not really. I don't know that it's the not really. I mean, I think that we are searching for truth. It's just that when we find it, we don't always like what we find.
Yeah. How do you respond?
And that's, it's not that we're not
that's good.
Searching.
Yeah.
And so when we look at, you know, like other religions, like Buddhism or Hinduism or whatever, like, oh, well, they're not really looking for truth. They're just looking for.
No, they absolutely are.
Like,
yeah.
Why would that ever come into our thought?
Right.
That, well, you know, the whoever aren't, you know, they're sort of, like, the Methodists are sort of the truth.
Right.
Not really.
Yeah.
You know, because that's actually the truth. And, you know, that's very much.
It's like, a false gospel.
Well, it is. Like,
yeah.
It is a false gospel, but it's very much like what the Pharisees themselves were doing.
Yeah.
And saying, no, we are legitimately on the path to serve God in the right way.
Yep.
Every single minute of every single day, this is what we're doing.
Yep.
And there is definitely a measure of, well, are you though? Because, you know, are you more interested in finding the truth, or are you more interested in perfecting the system?
Reinforcing what you already think is true.
Right. And that I think is the piece that speaks into our own hearts, where am I interested in finding truth regardless of what that is and what it's and how I get there?
Yeah.
You know, do I have to go all the way to Jerusalem, or can I stay home?
Yeah.
You know, or is it more that, well, I know that this is what's right.
Right.
I know that this is what's true.
Right.
And as long as the truth fits into my paradigm, I'm willing to accept.
Yeah.
And that's not something that other people deal with. That's something that I deal with.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is right in my house. That is not some other thing to look for.
And absolutely.
At the same time, I, you know, again, I think it's not so much that it's out of a insincerity in searching for truth, but it's when we find that truth and it doesn't fit with my expectations, with my system, with my belief structure, with my assumptions.
Yeah.
Then the question is, okay, what are you looking for?
Right.
At that moment, what am I actually searching for? Am I actually searching for truth, or am I searching for what I expect?
A lot of the skepticism that we read over the woman, with like where she's evasive and she's asking these religiously complicated questions, we're actually probably reading our own hearts into that to a measure. Because I think that for a lot of people that would have been the result, especially for the Jews that were true, pure Jews, and you see that with Nicodemus, which we'll get to next time. His receiving of Jesus has a different flavor. It doesn't mean it wasn't real, and it doesn't mean, I mean, we believe sincerely that he was one of the ones that comes into the truth, but his journey into there was through a death to his expectations, and it was a hard, heavy release. Where in this case, and I think part of the reason why there was more of that, you know, okay, but so yes, I want that water. I don't care what it is. I don't care. I want it. And there's a sincerity in her statement. And do I have to go to Jerusalem, or can I stay here? Because I'll go to Jerusalem if I need to. I mean, theoretically, you could kind of sense this earnestness, this eagerness in her heart to let go of anything for the sake of what was being offered. Even tradition, even expectation, and it's easier. And here's the thing. Jesus says this how many times? It is easier for somebody who has a poverty of spirit, somebody who has tried everything and found nothing satisfies, to let go of all the stuff that you've had to a measure. Hey, someone's calling, just so you guys know. It looks like a sales call to me. I'm going to refuse it. So do you guys want me to answer like a church? Hello? Hey, guys, you want a timeshare? Okay, so the significance of what was being offered in that moment, and the fact that she's, you know, somebody who comes to the end of themselves, who has legitimately tried everything and found it wanting, there's an openness to that. Yeah.
And you see the contrast of how people respond differently to the presentation of the gospel.
Right.
But Christ offers it's the same thing, but it's different. Like, it looks
for every person.
Like,
yeah.
The rich guy who's like, awesome, you're seeking for truth, that's great.
Right.
Abandon your wealth.
Right.
The thing that you trust in, and come and follow me.
Yeah.
You know, and what did he tell Nicodemus? Abandon your upbringing.
Yeah.
abandon your
genetics.
Yeah. Abandon your training, yep. Abandon your assumptions.
Don't teach everything for next week.
And come and follow.
Yeah.
And, you know, this woman, what did he say? Because to the rich man, he said, sell all that you have.
Yep.
You know, to Nicodemus, he said, you have to be born again.
Yep.
You have to start over your life.
Yep.
And to this woman, he says, go get your husband.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So she's asking, how do I get this? He said, well, go get your husband. Because that is what she was chasing. And
yep.
I mean, if we read that rightly, where she was pursuing that, and here we find Nicodemus had come to the end of his trust and said, there's got to be something more.
Yep.
Here this woman has come to the end of the thing she trusts and said, there's got to be something more. And then, you know, the rich man is like,
I can't do that.
Add this to what I've got.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, that's not what that's like.
Yep.
You have to abandon whatever it is you're trusting, whether it's your religious system, your place in society, you're looking
marital status.
Yeah, you're looking for comfort or security or whatever. Or whatever it is, you have to be willing to abandon that because you have to give that up in place of me. And I am the way. It's not about the other things that you think about. It's about me and me only.
We've missed in our training of the presentation of the gospel. We have become very misinformed about what it means to present Christ to someone. And it takes a lot of work to sort of separate yourself from some of the old traditions that weren't altogether wrong, but they were missing the point. And usually, if you have an honest conversation with somebody for any period of time, you will, especially if you have, if you've gone ahead beforehand and said, God, guide me into truth here by your Spirit. Help me to find the place that this person is seeking you. You walk into their world, and I cannot tell you. I can't think of a time when it hasn't happened. We're in a conversation with somebody who's a true seeker. You get to the place where they identify for you, in clear terms, what they're trusting in. For hope, for security, for life, for happiness. And that stuff comes through. And in our world, we actually are even more, to a measure, I feel like we're even more obvious with that stuff. I know this is going to be a little weird, but truthfully, after I meet somebody and I talk with them, I did this last week. I met with a guy, a really interesting, fascinating meeting. And I'm like, God, what was that? Like, there was so much about it that I'm still confused to a measure about. So I requested him to be my friend on Facebook. And I don't usually go on Facebook except to stalk people after I first meet them. I don't know. But you go there and you look at that and you realize there is so much that's set out there in public view that says, this is me. This is how I define myself. And I look at my own Facebook and I'm like, yeah, that's pretty accurate even for me, like family and my kids. And I mean, there are a lot of things that we can set up and say, this is my confidence. And the answer every time is Christ comes to those places and says, if you want me, you got to trade me for the God that you have now. But the thing that's interesting is that Jesus always offers it back. That's the thing. I will give you wealth beyond your wildest imagination if you give me your pittance that you have trusted in this whole life. I will give you satisfaction, a quenching of this thirst for security, for identity, for all this stuff to this woman. There will be a well of water that springs up within you, and you'll never have to worry again for how that's going to work. With Nicodemus, this, you start fresh and it's going to be everything you've ever hoped and more. And that's the promise of the gospel, is that if you're willing to give up the thing that you're currently trusting in, the God that you currently follow, whatever that is, give it to God. And sometimes you have to watch him kill it. And it is horrifying for the moment. But when he brings it back to life, you wonder why you didn't do it sooner. That's the message of the gospel. That's what we proclaim, is that it is worth it. It is absolutely 100% worth it. But I know all of them, because I've said all of them. But the truth is, it is everything you hoped it would be and more. And anything less than that is exactly that. It's less than that. It's not what you think it is. And it will end up being your downfall. The rich man goes away very sorrowful. In all of his wealth, he was sorrowful because he couldn't find him. He couldn't see himself giving up that God. It's good. Last thoughts. Noon. Thank you for this for this amazing story, Lord, that often gets misinterpreted and overlooked and misunderstood. God, I pray that we will see what you are proclaiming to our own hearts in this space. Lord, I pray that we will understand the value, the immeasurable depth, the unsearchableness of the depth of what you have offered in Christ. Lord, please protect us from systems that are divorced of your Spirit. Lord, protect us from traditions that keep us from releasing all of ourselves to you. Lord, I pray that you will quench the thirst of your people. Lord, I pray that we will be satisfied beyond measure, and that wealth of hope, that overflow of all of you will spill onto others, that others will be able to recognize as we proclaim this truth. Come, meet a man who meets my every need. Come, be introduced to the one that may very well be and is, in fact, Christ, Messiah, the hope we've all been waiting for. God, I pray that you will be with our church. God, we are not good at highlighting the satisfaction that we have in our own hearts. Lord, we are so weak in the way that we proclaim our satisfaction. We're inhibited by so many things that stand in the way. God, I pray that by your Spirit, you will fill us up and overflowing with what is true, and that will produce in the lives of the people that we love a longing to give up their gods for you. God, help us to direct people to you. Help us to introduce people to the hope they've been waiting for your sake, for your glory, because it's what you've called us to, and it's what you've given us our gifts for. Lord, I pray that all of this will be done so that your church can continue to do what it ought, for your sake, for our good, and for your glory. Amen.